Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 21st of August 2007. Interesting show coming up with Christina Hoff Summers. She's one of the world's leading commentators on gender. She's written two major books, Where Goes Feminism?
Who Stole Feminism?
Sorry. And The War Against Boys. And she's it's been a long-term dream of Dad's on the Air to have Christina Hoff Summers on the show, so that should be a really good interview. We've also got an interview with Philip Ruddock. Basically, he was cornered at this conference down in Canberra, and all the blokes were having a go at him. A lot of unhappy blokes trying to put a bee in his ear, and we've recorded some of his responses, so we'll be taking a look at that. We've also got this politician from South Australia.
Yeah, Anne Bressington. She's an independent MP in South Australia, and she came to Sydney last week to speak at an event organised by the Human Rights and Equal Opportunities Commission, and she's got some great things to say about family law reform and dealing with issues of family law and child protection, so we'll have her on the show as well.
And we'd like to welcome all the people who are joining us from around the world via live streaming on the 2GLF website. That's 893fm.com.au. And don't forget, you can also listen to this program within 24 hours. It should be up online at www.dadsontheair.net. The problems which plagued us for many years with the shows not going up for months after and afterwards they broadcast are now over, thankfully, and you'll be able to listen to that within 24 hours up on our website. First up, we'll just take a look at this story that's been published in the Herald Sun in Melbourne. One third of separated fathers have little or no contact with their kids, according to the latest Australian Bureau of Statistics research. Now, this, of course, is a direct result of government policy. We pay taxes to achieve this dire social outcome. The 2006 census also shows that one-parent families, which are overwhelmingly headed by women, now make up 15% of all families. The lack of contact is despite a determined effort on behalf of separated dads to play a significant hands-on role in their children's life. One third of separated fathers have little or no contact with their kids. Many of these heartbroken dads have waged major campaigns through the courts in order to get to see their kids. They've consumed, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars in these desperate efforts to see these kids, and yet the judiciary and the bureaucracy backing them up deny those kids the right to see their father. What an absolute disgrace this is.
Yeah, that's a shocker.
According to the latest child support figures, which you can never trust anything that comes out of the CSA, more than 21% of parents that are paid child support are now men looking after their kids as the primary carer. This completely contradicts, and I don't know how you get these figures, the other figure that 97% of people who pay child support are male. So on one point they're putting out a statistic claiming that 21% of parents are men at the primary carers, which is a absolutely disgraceful legal term, primary care. It perpetuates a lie, basically, that, you know, one parent is the primary care and one isn't. It's a legal fiction, something like terra nullis, that allows them to perform some pretty horrific abuses of natural
justice. Works in
justice.
The adversarial court system, so you get a winner and a loser.
Yeah, pits the male against the female, and it, it's nothing but a money-grabbing exercise in the end.
The show goes on to, we'll have to do we'll have to interview some of these people. There's a groundbreaking new program conducted by YMCA and Victoria Relationships Australia, always a staunchly feminist organisation, Men's Line, and they're launching a program called Dad's Link. We'll be taking a look at that in future programs. Dad's Link's aims to bring fathers together to receive counselling. They always assume fathers need counselling. What happens to all these studies and newspaper reports that show that people who get counselled often do worse? But the government continues to counsel us to within an inch of our lives. We know many fathers have an enormously important role to play in their children's lives. And Victorian Chief Executive Peter Byrne said, it's nice of you to
acknowledge that, Peter. Very insightful, yes. Yeah.
Really insightful. Something I really want to just bring to people's attention is a new book that's out called What's Left? How Liberals Lost Their Way. It's only just become available for sale in Australia in the last couple of weeks. You can get it at all good bookshops. What's Left? How Liberals Lost Their Way. It's by a columnist for that left-wing Guardian, Nick Cohen, who was a columnist there. And he wrote that one of the great things that had happened in this culture was the liberal left pretense that families really don't count. And he goes, and now look at us. The work ethic is gone, family values are gone, courtesy is gone and common decency is gone. Crime, child abuse and robbery have grown like Topsy. The culture is awash with obscenity and the sexual exploitation of women. Universal state education has had the remarkable effect of making today's pupils stupider than their predecessors. The National Health Service, this is talking about UK, but the same thing applies to Australia. The National Health Service cannot treat the sick. However much money the taxpayer throws at it. State benefits discourage people from looking after themselves and others. State schools and hospitals destroy the old mutual and charitable ideals which gave the working and middle classes control over institutions. The worst of it is the ludicrous liberal pretense that the traditional family doesn't matter. Divorce and step-parenthood exposes children and boys to rape while single mothers can't instill discipline in the young. The unhappy children who stagger away from the state-sponsored emotional wreckage are responsible for a substantial amount of the dramatically increased levels of crime. Also,
In this morning's Telegraph, the shocking headline that strikes you as soon as you look at the thing is flu fiasco revealed. Low-dose vaccine puts children at risk. Sue Dunleavy writes, children vaccinated against the killer flu epidemic may not be fully protected because new advice says they need double the dose. Doctors were warned late last week that the flu vaccine dose recommended for children aged up to 3 is only half as strong as new evidence suggests is needed. Now, everybody knows that we've had this disgusting flu epidemic rip through Australia over the last month or so. There have been 6 children die of this, which is an absolute disgraceful situation. Personally, I am a skeptic when it comes to vaccination generally. My son is not vaccinated, and I would actually invite any of the listeners out there who are experts or who have strong opinions, anybody qualified, perhaps you're a doctor, perhaps you're a naturopath, a homeopath, with a strong opinion and information to back up a point of view about vaccination, if you could contact Dads on the Air through our website, dadsontheair.net, and we would like to schedule a debate and a discussion on vaccination generally sometime in the next 2 to 3 months. So anybody out there with expertise in that field, please contact Dads on the Air and we will be happy to include you in our program that we are planning for the future.
There is a vaccination court in the US which deals solely with cases of kids who've been disabled as a result of vaccinations, and it was a result of they put this mercury, I think it was, that used to preserve the vaccine, and they knew and have always known that a small percentage of people that were given the vaccines would be permanently disabled as a result.
Also, there's an autism epidemic going on at the moment, and autism is not contagious and it's not handed down genetically. And I think it's something like 188 cases per 1,000 occurring in the United States of children with autism, which is an epidemic, and this has been linked to vaccination. I think there is a point to be made that drug companies via doctors are basically pushing their drugs, and that the medical benefit of some of these products, especially vaccinations, is definitely in doubt. So we definitely need to get some doctors. We need pro and con people regarding this particular debate so we can have a serious discussion and hopefully get to the bottom of whether vaccination is a good thing or whether this epidemic of flu, the fact that the strain has got stronger, is this in any way caused by the vaccination? Were any of the children who died, for example, had they been vaccinated? This is information which doesn't seem to be in the public domain and which I think Dads on the Air really needs to get out there.
There's only one person who really knows the answer to all that, and that's Elvis.
Yes, this week saw the 30th anniversary of the death of Elvis. We like to pay a little tribute to a great entertainer. He entertained us for many years. He's put hundreds of songs out there. He was also a dad, and all those that have experienced the loss of contact with their children will utter the same words as the title of this next Elvis song, Walk a Mile in My Shoes.
I know, I just said, man, I'm about to lose my... Anyway... My scarf's too short, my belt's falling off. Losing my mind, you know. If I could be you, if you could be me, for just 1 hour. If we could find a way to get inside each other's minds. If you could see you through my eyes instead of your ego, I believe it'd be a surprise to see that you've been blind. Walk a mile in my shoes. Hey! Just walk a mile in my shoes. Yeah, before you abuse, criticize, and accuse, just walk a mile in my shoes. Now if we spend the day throwing stones at one another, cause I don't think I'll wear my hair same way you do. Oh, well I may be common people, but I'm your brother. And when you strike out to try to hurt me, it's a hurting you. Lord have mercy. Walk a mile in my shoes. Hey. Walk a mile in my shoes. Yeah. Yeah, before you abuse, criticize, and accuse. Walk a mile in my shoes. Now there are people on reservation and out in the ghetto. And brother there, for the grace of God, go you and I. If I only had the wings of a little angel, don't you know I'd fly to the top of a mountain and then I'd cry, cry, cry. Walk a mile in my shoes. Just walk a mile in my shoes. Yo. Yeah, before you criticize and accuse, walk a mile in my shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes. Hey. Walk a mile in my shoes. Yeah, before you abuse, criticize and accuse, walk a mile in my shoes.
Last month, I attended an amazing American conference in Washington, D.C. called Boys and the Boy Crisis. The conference looked at the growing gap between girls and boys from kindergarten through to university and discussed ways in which the increasingly feminized education system could be made more boy-friendly. One of the conference highlights was the presentation by Christina Hoff Sommers, author of Who Stole Feminism and The War Against Boys. Hoff Sommers is currently resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research in Washington. She's also chairman of the board of academic advisors to the Independent Women's Forum and was formerly a university professor of philosophy. An equity feminist, passionate about working towards true equality between men and women, Hoff Sommers has been an outspoken critic of those radical gender feminists who have taken an openly misandrist stance, throwing out reason, evidence, and scholarship in an effort to sanctify females and demonize males. I recorded Hoff Sommers' conference presentation, which will shortly be available on DVD from the conference website at trueequality.com. We're going to start today by listening to a short excerpt from her presentation. My apologies in advance for the quality of the audio recording.
Let me briefly describe what it was like writing on behalf of boys 10 or 15 years ago. The nation was in the grips of a full-scale girl crisis, Girls were portrayed as confused, silenced, timorous, demoralized, diminished, forlorn. It's impossible to exaggerate the urgency and poignancy, increasing urgency of this movement. Here's a typical passage in Reviving Ophelia. Something dramatic happens to girls in early adolescence. Just as planes and ships disappear mysteriously into the Bermuda Triangle, so do the selves of girls go down in droves. They crash and burn.
Oh, God.
Now, the problem is, contrary to this story told by Mary Pfeiffer and dozens of books and articles that came out at the time, by the early 1990s, American girls were flourishing in unprecedented ways. To be sure, there were some that were crashing and burning in a psychological Bermuda Triangle, but the vast majority of girls were occupied in far more constructive ways. They were moving ahead of little boys in elementary school and in high school. They were applying to college in record numbers. They were filling, you know, their schedules with more and more challenging academic classes, joining sports teams, and generally enjoying more freedoms and opportunities than any young women in human history. Girls were definitely not in crisis in the early 90s. Indeed, this could be said accurately to be the beginning of a kind of golden age of women's education, girls' education. It was boys. If you had to choose a gender that was on the fragile side of the education gap, it was boys who were not keeping up. The U.S. Department of Education released a report called Trends in Educational Equity. And they said in the press release and in the report itself, there is evidence that the female advantage in school performance is real and persistent. And among their key findings is, yes, boys outnumber girls in sports. Girls outnumber boys in just about everything else. Student government, school newspapers, enrollment in advanced placement classes, honor society, etc. Males do slightly better than females on the national math and science tests. Females do vastly better than males on reading and writing. And I remember something just jumped out at me. Well, it turns out that the average 17-year-old American boy has the writing skills of a 14-year-old girl. He is 3 years behind on average. And again, well, you know, this is something, this is significant. This is a gap that should have been of concern. When we looked at the math gap and the science gap were tiny compared to the reading and writing gap. And we haven't even talked about the engagement gap, how much more girls care. The gender gap in education is salient and central in every economic and social and ethnic group. American girls are outperforming American boys. You know, if it's Hispanic kids, if it's black, I mean, black kids, it's amazing. Almost all the benefits of the civil rights movement went to women, African-American women. And they are much stronger, and the gaps are larger. But it's the boys, of course, languishing. And then you go to working-class white boys. These critics admit they're in trouble, but then go to middle-class communities. Judith Kleinfeld is a professor of psychology at University of Alaska. Some may know her wonderful website, The Boys Project. And she's done a thorough analysis of the reading skills of white males from college-educated families. So this is the group we're not supposed to worry about. So these feminist critics, they admit all the other groups. And by the way, if you just take black boys, Hispanic boys, and working class white boys, it's already millions of boys, so there's already a problem. But I think we can also add the middle class boys in terms of academic deficits, because as she showed, she used Department of Education data. She shows that at the end of high school, 23% of white sons of college educated parents scored below basic in reading. For girls, it was 7%. 23% males, 7% females. That means, Ms. Kleinfeld says, that one in four boys who have college-educated parents can't read a newspaper with understanding. Gender is the constant.
I was fortunate enough to speak with Hoff Summers after her presentation. I started off by asking her the big question about the boy crisis.
Across the Western world, we know that boys are more likely to commit suicide, to be diagnosed with learning disabilities, to be murder victims, to die on our roads, to abuse drugs and alcohol, to suffer injuries, violence. And obviously the gap between boys and girls has been increasing right across the education system, all the way from preschool right through to university. What do you see might be some of the main causes for this boy crisis?
Well, as you were reeling off all the terrible things boys do happen to boys and that boys do, I was thinking there are also all these wonderful things that boys do. I mean, the thing about males is they succeed and they fail spectacularly. So, yes, you have higher suicide rates and you have higher incarceration rates, all the things you say. But you also, who's more likely to invent something, a boy or a girl, you know, a young man? Men are still, by and large, the inventors, getting the patents, starting companies. So it's a very creative source, force in the world, but also it takes a toll. So I think that we have to understand that boys and girls are somewhat different. There are exceptions, but I'm talking about the rules. And that a young man in a classroom may need a special kind of understanding, and the teachers may need special training in how to educate boys. And I worry that in the United States, that it's an art that's at risk of being lost forever, because we're so focused on, we have been so focused on the needs of girls, we forgot about boys and all of the problems that you mentioned, but also all of the wonderful things about them that we want to protect and nurture.
So when we talk about a boy crisis, we're not talking about the boys at the top end of the bell curve, right, but we're talking about the boys at the bottom end and bringing them up into the middle or...
Well, it's complicated because in terms of boys in very serious psychological crisis, that's still a tiny minority. Boys are overall healthy and thriving, but they can create trouble for themselves and others. And academically, they're more difficult to interest in, to engage in education. And of course, they're the exceptions, top of the class, young man, he's good at everything, but that is very much the exception. Even if you have a talented, brilliant boy, it's harder for the teacher to interest him than the girl sitting next to him. So teachers have to be aware of that. They have to make special efforts to introduce reading materials that boys like. I'm sorry, but they, you know, in many American classes, they read books about women and their self-esteem issues. Or a friend of mine's a literacy expert. She used to be at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and she said you would think that these American textbooks that are used in 8th and 9th grade social studies, you would think the American West was settled by teenage girls traveling with parents because they edit out the heroes and the adventurers and models for young boys. And that's got to change.
Right. What personally motivated you to write such a book as The War Against Boys? What was your personal interest that led to writing that book?
Yes, I wrote the book on boys because before that I wrote a book called Who Stole Feminism? And as a philosophy professor and consider myself an equity feminist, I care about fairness and social justice. And what I saw was when I wrote Who Stole Feminism, there was a lot of injustice towards men. I became a feminist because I did not like chauvinism and male bullies, but I was seeing around me female chauvinists and female bullies, and I didn't like it any better. I didn't become a feminist because I was a female chauvinist, but because I was committed to fairness. So that troubled me, and I found an enormous amount of misinformation, misinformation, if you will, just gender propaganda coming out of women's research centers that had never been subject to review and correction if it was an error. And a lot of it was overstating and exaggerating women as victims and men as brutes and so forth. And the area where I found immense amount of misinformation and propaganda was in education. So the book, in a way, grew out of the earlier one where I was correcting falsehoods. As a philosophy professor, minimally, you know, it's hard enough to reason and to make inferences and reasonable theories, but you have to have accurate information. And what I found is the base, that we have a body of egregiously false information at the heart of contemporary feminism.
We'll be back with more of Christina Hoff Summers in a moment.
The kids are fine, that they miss me. Maybe I could come and babysit sometime. She says, are you okay? I was worried about you. Can you forgive me? I hope that you'll be happy. I say, I'm so happy that I can't stop crying. I was worried about you. I heard she had another man. I wondered how you felt about it. I'm so happy that I can't stop crying. I'm so happy I'm laughing through my tears. So my lawyer, Mr. Good News, he got me joint custody and legal separation. For my kids and one star for my wife. Something made me smile. Something seemed to ease the pain. Something about the universe and how it's all connected. Should be with his mother. Everybody knows that. We can't afford the doobas, babysit sometimes. So that friend of mine, he said, you look different somehow. I said, everybody's got to leave that darkness sometimes. I said, I'm so happy.
Talking with Christina Hoff Summers, author of The War Against Boys, at the Boys and the Boy Crisis Conference in Washington, D.C.
What I've noticed with some of the speakers at this conference and at the conference I attended a couple of weeks ago in Australia, dealing with the boy crisis in education and dealing with making academic environments more conducive to the ways the boys like to learn and making them more engaging for boys and more relevant for boys, what I've found is there's been an absence in talking about making the tertiary environment boy-friendly. And as someone who's been an undergraduate student at a Western university over the last 3 years, I've found that the environment there is extremely anti-male, extremely toxic, and often anti-intellectual, as you've been saying, with feminism having heavily influenced social sciences, public health.
Which school were you in?
I was at three different universities in Adelaide, and all three of them in Adelaide.
Really?
And I found the same environment. What would you see as any sort of antidote or any sort of positive solutions that could be put in place in universities to try and make them a bit more boy-friendly, as well as obviously the primary schools and high schools, which...
Oh, well, I absolutely agree. In fact, I would go so far as to say that in the United States, it may be the universities that are the most seriously afflicted with misandry, real male-hating. We have this play called The Vagina Monologues by Eve Ensler. I'm sure she's visited Australia. She's been in Cairo. My goodness, she's certainly been to Sydney and Melbourne. But this play, it creates a kind of cultic following. For a small percentage of girls, it's the most important event of their college career. And why? It's just if you reduced it to a few phrases, you know, it would be women are from Venus, men are from hell. And the girls... small percentage anyway, seem to enjoy it. But it's creating this, as I said, this male-averse environment. And then they have Take Back the Night marches where they take microphones and they tell about all the terrible things that have happened to them. And some of them make it up. They'll mention boys' names who are innocent. We've had that happen.
Wow.
So it's actually very, very unhealthy. Even if a girl has genuinely been assaulted. I don't think she should be just talking about it on a microphone, so I think it's even abusive of people who have been victims of crimes. But nevertheless, that's American campuses. And then you have the intellectual corruption in women's studies, which is just far too much propaganda and political ideology and not serious scholarship.
And this often in an environment where in a lot of disciplines, you might be the only boy in the class. So not only are you being taught this hostile anti-male stuff, but you're probably too scared to even say anything because...
There's a lot of policing in the classroom. If a young man says the wrong thing, then there are 15 angry women that turn.
And there's nothing worse, for a man than to feel sort of shamed in that way.
I once saw a video of primates, I think it was gorillas, or where they have these alpha males, gorillas, or maybe they were chimps, but very, very patriarchal. But when the women would get together and start, you know, complaining and scolding, he would just retreat and go away. And even among the primates, they don't like scolding women.
One of the things I've been hearing about the atmosphere in a lot of Western high schools is that because the girls, especially in the areas of literacy, of reading and writing, language skills, because they are generally outperforming boys, learning or being good at school is almost starting to be seen as girls' stuff.
Right.
And that to me seems to be incredibly worrying, because there's something about being a boy that it's important not to be seen to be doing girls' stuff.
Absolutely.
And if learning is now girls' stuff,
right,
can you possibly think of any antidote to this? Because it seems like such a damaging...
It's very damaging. Yeah. One thing that I found impressive in reading about China and India is the superstars for many young people are people like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. And if they visit, there'd be like a youth riot of happiness to see them. And that's very good to have role models. And that's marked, I mean, that's a masculine role model for young men. And then it makes it look like math and science is acceptable and attractive and manly and so forth. But you're touching on something very important, because women don't mind being tomboys or being seen as acting like a boy. Sometimes there's more flexibility with boys. Harvey Mansfield at Harvard University wrote a book on manliness, and he's very brilliant on this. About it's true that men do, if something becomes feminized, they will avoid it. And anyone that cares about young men has to worry about protecting them from this kind of stereotype where learning and literacy and being good at school is marked as feminine. This is something new, something we can change, but we have to be aware of it. And we have to be willing to allow for a remasculinization of the curriculum, at least some of it, so girls can choose the books they want and boys can choose eventually. The boy becomes highly literate, they'll come together and study the same things. But certainly in the lower grades, the classrooms in American schools, I remember one superintendent outside Detroit, Bloomfield Hills, she told me that the classrooms were really designed by women for girls, full of daisies and snowflakes. And she said to the teachers, can't you just put an occasional rocket ship or a snake or, a dangerous animal and so forth? And I think all that, again, if the little boy comes into the class run by most elementary schools by a woman, female domain, and rules that girls find easier to live by than he does, he's alienated from the beginning. And I think we can, if we cared about boys, which we do, but I don't think, we're organized enough around that purpose. But if we do become organized, I think we will change our classrooms and make him feel more comfortable that it's his place as well.
Mm. Now, we're running out of time. Just one final question. You'd be aware that society often works with pendulum swings.
Yes.
So we started off in an era where, as you said in your presentation today, there were and still are some areas where girls were and are behind in the areas of science and maths and perhaps in sporting areas.
Yes.
And so we put in place measures to address this, and it's done a lot, but it's swung the pendulum. And now, obviously, we're starting to put in place measures for boys. Right. The danger, and I guess this is maybe the worst fear of most feminists, is that the pendulum will swing so far back the other way that it will
undo
the good work that we've done for girls. How do you see us stopping that pendulum swing?
Well, I think that it's, as I said in my talk today, I do think that there were wonderful achievements of the girl power movement, the numbers of girls that now participate in sports and girls that are considering careers in math and science, it's increased. It's not parity with men, but it's increased dramatically. That's very good for the society and for the girls. But I just don't accept it when those say, if we start having programs to strengthen boys where they're weak reading and writing, that's going to somehow harm the girls. I don't see how that could do anything but help them, because if it improves the young men with whom they're going to build a future, that is to everyone's advantage. So I think that we have a new consciousness. If we all have a feminist consciousness, whether we're equity feminists like me or radical feminists, we all have. And you don't lose that. We're aware. We men today, I mean, they have daughters and sisters, and they care about them as much as their sons and brothers. So I think that there's that awareness it's not easy to lose. And I think there will be a correction, and we'll be all much the better for it.
Right. So hopefully, because we've all got that awareness now,
yes,
wins for boys will actually be win-win.
That's right.
We won't have a win-lose or a zero-sum game.
That's right. And I think what some of the things that I've heard today is that people that have organized events for boys, they're very well attended and they're very popular. Only a tiny, tiny group object. So I think a lot of women are of goodwill and will understand that there's a need, and they will try to meet that need.
Mm. Great. Christine Huff Summers, it's been a pleasure talking with you today.
Very nice talking to you, Greg.
Thank you.
If you'd like a DVD copy of The Boys and the Boy Crisis Conference, you can register your interest at the conference website, trueequality.com. We'll be featuring more interviews from the conference over the coming weeks. If you'd like to find out more about Christine Huff Summers and read some of her fantastic articles, you can find them at aei.org/scholars. That's scholars. This is Greg Andreessen reporting for Dads on the Air.
Well, I'm a lone father, you see, and it's not only happening to me. Yeah, there's one thing for certain, my poor heart keeps hurting, and there's thousands of blokes just like me. When she left, she took all my dreams of us and of our family. Oh, it's just so sad when kids can't see their dads, and that is a real tragedy. My wife's trying to ruin my life, and to see my kids in court, I fight. Seems there's one law for mothers and another for us fathers, and some will use children for spite. You see, and it's not only happening to me. No, I cannot fathom the lies that she's telling to keep my children from me. But it was her vows, and it's so clear to me now. Yeah, she called me honey, now she wants my money, but I have to help my kids somehow. Yeah, my wife's out to my life, and she's causing me all sorts of strife. My poor kids are confused. you go broke and you're poor, you lose faith in the Lord. That's when some lonely dads take their life. Yes, I'm all on fire, you see. And it's not all blokes just like me. Yeah, there's thousands of blokes just like me.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And that was Dale Huff from Queensland, another original, played first on the Dads on the Air program and indeed commercial radio. By all means, folks, we look forward to receiving original material. We're starting to collect this sort of material from all over the world, and it's interesting how fathers, especially fathers, but also some mothers, even some daughters and sons, are sending us material to deal with their outrage and pain.
Okay, well, now on the line we have from the Dad Lab, Dr. Dad.
How are you going, Ian?
Very well indeed. Welcome to Dad's on the Air. Now, you've come up with some very interesting scientific research that's been conducted lately. Would you like to fill us in a little bit on what you have dug up?
There's been some medical research over a decade now that has established that a mother's attachment and bonding to her infant regulates the normal brain development of the child.
Yep.
But within that paradigm, the father's contribution to the normal brain development of the child has been ignored. Up until this paper was recently published, and I got to qualify that the research has been done on an animal model, on the Dagus rat, but the Dagus rat has a very similar brain structure to the human. And in this model, there were two groups that were studied. There were the mother-father-absent offspring group, and then the mother-father-present offspring group.
Yep.
And nothing changed between the mothers in the two groups. They mothered exactly the same.
Okay.
The only difference between the two groups was one group had a father and the other group was father absent. And then what they did was, after about 6 weeks, they chopped up the brains of the offspring.
Oh, very nice.
Very nice. But yeah. This is the way this sort of research evolves.
Sure. Well, they didn't do it with young children, so that's okay.
Yeah, but I don't know if that'd pass the ethics committee. But
no, it wouldn't pass around here, mate. We wouldn't be condoning that kind of behaviour at all. But anyway, go on. They did this to rats, so...
All the mother bonding stuff started with animal models and then progressed to human models, where they used magnetic resonance imaging to image the children's brain. So...
And what did it show, basically? Can you just sum up the finding?
Well, basically it shows that father absence... and this is where the mother-infant bond is normal, that father absence per se causes brain damage to the offspring.
Okay, so could you elaborate a little bit more? I mean, what part of the brain specifically are they showing that is affected, and how is it affected?
Well, it's the anterior cingulate cortex.
Which means what to the 60-year-old audience that's listening to us?
Well, it's a part of the brain that they reckon now is involved in emotional bonding.
Mm-hmm.
It's a part of the brain that's rich in oxytocin receptors, and oxytocin is considered as a bonding hormone. New mothers have a rapid rise in oxytocin, but we know now that new fathers have a similar rise. So the part of the brain that's damaged in the father-absent animals is the part that regulates the emotional response to the broader world, and specifically the nerves that are damaged are those nerves that inhibit one's the emotional response of the infant to the
And has there been anything to show that this actually happens in humans as well, that if the father is absent, your emotional development is curtailed?
Well, as I said, John, the animal work started with mother-child deprivation and then moved to the human situation. So this work on father absence now has been established in an animal model to cause brain damage. And it's conceivable that in the very near future, studies will be able to be done on humans using new medical technology to establish the same as what's been established with mother-child deprivation.
So this research could in fact be the smoking gun that puts the lie to the feminist propaganda that says...
No doubt. This group of researchers in Germany extrapolates that that they're actually trying to find a brain retardation a basis for the social effects that have been well observed in fatherless children.
Yep.
Just for all you nerds out there, this research was published in Brain Research. You can get it at a website, www.sciencedirect.com. The research paper is called Lack of Paternal Care Affects Synaptic Development in the Anterior... How do you pronounce it? Cingulate cortex.
Cingulate cortex, John.
Right, and it's by Vladimir.
Maybe we could actually post a citation on dadsontheair.net.
Perhaps we could.
Yeah, we'll do that.
Vladimir Ostrush. No, I can't pronounce half these people. Karina Helmick and Catherine Braun. Okay, just to sum up, just how significant is this research?
This is a threshold paper, John. Threshold in that it redefines a paradigm of what fathers do in terms of the brain development of their offspring, and it seems that what fathers do is something that mothers can't do. So it's independent. Fathers bring something unique to the brain development of their offspring.
That's very very interesting research. That was Dr. Dad from our new fortnightly segment, Dr. Dad.
We'll be back. Dad Lab.
From the Dad Lab. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John and Ian.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that heartbreak hotel where I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely. I'll be just so lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted mothers to cry there in the gloom. I'll be just so lonely, baby. I'll be just so lonely. I'll be so lonely, I could die. Keep flowing, the desk clerks dressed in black. Well, they've been so long on the street, they'll never look back and think you're so, think you're so lonely, baby. Well, they're so lonely, well, they're so lonely, and they could die. Well, if your baby leaves you, you've got a tale to tell. Well, just take a walk down the street to Heartbreak Hotel, where you will be, because so lonely, baby. Well, you'll be lonely, you'll be so lonely, you could die.
We're back with Dads on the Air. And the roving microphone of Dads on the Air attended the Lone Fathers Conference in Canberra just recently, and the Attorney General, Philip Ruddock, spoke there, and he soon got the impression that the blokes were not happy. They cornered him. It's a long story, but he was cornered basically outside the conference in this corridor. We were surrounded by fathers who were all asking him questions. Here is a sample of what was going on.
So you can't ban one parent from removing the other parent from the child's life. You can only look at it 3 years down the track. Sort of thing.
Well, that's where it happens now, isn't it? I mean, you say you can't ban.
Make it legal. Check the child.
I don't know how you make it. Say a child is being exposed to danger and you make it illegal to remove a child.
Places where they're not exposed to danger.
Well, then ultimately you have to have a court system that is able to deal with it.
Well, it deals with ABOs.
The state courts deal with ABOs, not the family court or the magistracy, the federal magistracy. That's the point.
So you wouldn't be interested in dealing with exclusion in the same way?
I'm saying I think when you find, if these matters are dealt with less adversarially and the court lists start to contract, you may well be able to get to courts in a timely fashion. But at the moment, it's very difficult to get to courts.
But it's easy to exclude somebody on an ABO, but not... Anyway,
it's a state court.
Yeah, different court.
It is a state court.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, that was Attorney General Philip Ruddock answering the questions of an extremely disgruntled dad in the lobby at Parliament House at the Lone Fathers Conference.
And defending the indefensible, essentially. It was very noticeable throughout this that he still has no idea why he's running around peddling the indefensible, such soiled goods, and why his government, which had an historic opportunity to fix the vexed question of custody disputes in this country, chose instead to back up the bureaucracy, back up the corruption within the court, and back up the nightmare that is visited on any parents who are separating in this country. This is the next segment.
Yeah, we had approached you before about non-compliance or about this enforcement procedure by the family court. Judges are reluctant to enforce family law or penalty against contraventions. And the new legislation which came in July last year. Mm. The judges say in their written reasons for judgment by dismissing all those things, saying that this is not automatic to include new legislation in the old existing cases. So just they want to defy your new legislation or just ignore everything what's happening. There are various judges who doesn't want to
transformation. They're not applying law retrospectively.
No. Even in written form.
And look, I mean, it is unusual in Australia for laws to be made retrospective. So that when you put provisions in, an enactment, they relate to the way in which matters from then on are dealt with. And so if you're going back and saying 10 years ago, my wife contravened the order and now I want you to deal with it, the judge is going to say no.
But recent ones, they don't want to apply.
Well, if you have particular cases where you think judges are not applying the law,
yes,
and they're not giving sound reasons, let me know. What I've said in relation to these matters is that we expected that there would be a change. The reason that there were measures put into the Act was to ensure that the courts would be taking further steps to deal with enforcement. And if you say they are declining to do that, I need to know.
Yeah, the old judges,
so send me the examples.
They still want to stick with the old system. All things.
But you send me the examples.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I can give you various fathers, not me, just alone. There are various fathers.
You get a copy of the various judgments.
And the problem is
bring them to my attention.
Progressive ideas.
You send that to me.
Yeah.
If you've got a collection of
this mother. What I'm saying that we lost total faith or hope in family court, not federal magistrate system or any other court. So in this case, if we have any intervention system like intervention in Northern Territory, we can get intervention to rescue our children or reunite with our children. We are estranged for several years. And child abuse, you can say isolation, forceful isolation, or denial of contact is a kind of abuse. So in that case, intervention, you can make an option to save the fathers who are desperate.
Let me just say, the Northern Territory issue relates to contravention of the law, rape of children. If you think you have cases in which there is rape of children, it should be reported to police immediately.
Child,
that's the point I'm making. If you think it's just ordinary abuse And you've got a view that it's abuse, but...
I'm not sort of saying sexual abuse, but captivity.
But I'm saying if you're going to equate it with what's been happening in the Northern Territory, then what you're talking about is rape of children.
Yeah.
And if you know people who are raping children,
yeah.
that should be reported to police immediately. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
And it's an important issue that ought to be dealt with.
We have written to you, and the thing is, captivity situation, the child is captive, cannot be exposed to any other relative other than the mother or mother siblings in this sort of captivity issue for years after years, and all negotiations failed. This sort of hard issue that nobody listens, court judges, they don't want to listen. Family Relationship Center, we go, they say, we are not enforcement agency, we cannot enforce anything. That's how we are at loss.
Well, I hear what you're saying.
Well, all I'd say to that, Mr. Ruddick, is that all fathers would be most interested to know what your definition of ordinary abuse is. After all, abuse is abuse, isn't it? Justice Brennan, in his recent judgment in the Exclusive Brethren case, referred to the withholding of children from contact with their fathers as being at the higher end of the scale of abuse. And another point is, when fathers are prevented from seeing their children, how do they know that, and they worry about their kids perhaps being raped or abused by a de facto father.
And the horrifying thing was that was the Attorney General of Australia saying that he is not aware of case outcomes. We could quote him case outcomes.
I don't know.
All day.
Quote, unquote.
Yeah, I mean, he's the attorney. Surely it's
You're
his paid, job
what,
to know.
$400,000 a year? To say, I don't know.
Yeah, send me the results. Send me the cases, he says. I mean, doesn't he have a shelf packed with law books, like every good lawyer, that is full of these cases? They are unfolding every day in the family court.
Department chewing up hundreds of millions of dollars every year, who supposedly is monitoring these pathetic attempts. What is so sad about this is the venality of the government in intervening in the Northern Territory because they think it's a vote winner, but failing to enact laws which would bring about fairness and respect to parents and children alike in the family law jurisdiction.
And this is what independent MP Anne Bressington from South Australia will be talking about later in today's program, so stay tuned for that.
Mommy, when is Daddy coming home?
Walking down the street someday, if you come across my face and take a look into my eyes, will there be a state of grief? Will our memory rescue us? Was the bonding deep enough? Will the absence melt away? Or will pain light up the day? Stand.
every time I dream of you, but then the good part fades away, and I wake up in tears and blue.
We've got more of Philip Ruddock cornered in the corridor, surrounded by upset dads. He went away with the full impression that the new family law reforms are not working.
Yes, sir. I've been fighting for my children for 6 years or so. And I just, with the changes to the law, I just wonder if we've got it upside down, because to see my children, I have to go to court and apply all those principles that you've inserted about equal shared responsibility and consider equal time. But to do that, it's going to cost me well over $100,000. If we started the other way around and said everyone had a presumption of equal shared time, and then there were some odd cases, they could be forced to spend $100,000.
No, there is no case in which no matter how you get it there, if it's going to be fully brought out, won't cost both parties unless one of them is legally aided. Just turning around the presumptions. I mean, I think we've gone a long way in shifting the culture, but just turning around the presumptions. If people are still going to fight over it, it'll cost a lot of money.
But if you're not fighting, you say it starts at the beginning. If you start at the beginning, it's even.
I don't think it would. I mean, the whole point is that at the end of the day, people are going to find that their own circumstances warrant arrangements that will not be amenable to essentially a Solomon-like decision. I mean, if you're going to say split the time, you know, who gets the weekends, who gets the day and night, who gets the school holidays, you're going to do it equally, but, you know, you'll still fight over who gets what. I mean, at the end of the day, the people who know best what their individual circumstances are the parents.
It's just a starting point.
Thank you, Mr. Okay. The change has occurred. We'll see how it goes and then come back and revisit it. If it doesn't bring about the change that we want, then maybe we'll want to relook at it. But I'm not about... When we put these changes in place, they've been in place for 6 months or whatever it is, 12 months. I'm not about to say that we're going to go and revisit it immediately when all we're getting are anecdotal views about how you might best move forward. I mean, this went before the Parliamentary Committee. The Parliamentary Committee didn't accept what you were suggesting, and we've implemented what was suggested, and we'll now see how it works. Well, no, it's not wrong. We'll see how it works.
Went before a parliamentary committee. What a feeble, feeble excuse for enacting this piece of bastardry on the citizens of Australia. Most governments ignore almost everything that goes before a committee and almost everything that committees recommend. They only cherry-pick the things that suit them. It didn't, for whatever reason, for the protection of these utterly corrupt industry feeding off broken-hearted and separated parents, it didn't suit them to enact fairness in the law. But to say that a parliamentary committee recommended it, and if you look at the parliamentary committee, it was a completely dishonest and pathetic piece of work. Every picture tells a story. We said when it came out that it created as many problems as it solved, that the liars, the lawyers, the bureaucrats and the social engineers had won the day. And I think everything that's coming out of the Attorney-General's mouth proves exactly that.
The interesting thing was that it was a, make the point clearly that it was a bipartisan committee.
In other words, everyone can party policy that they've enacted.
They can all play a part in it.
It was a perfect wedge issue for the Conservatives because the fiasco that's been created on this was created by the left wing, by the Labor Party. Why they didn't pick up the cudgels and go for it, I know not. They're perfectly happy to do it in the Northern Territory, where the failed Labor Party policies in the remote area communities have led to a complete collapse of civil culture and of all common decency and so on, but not in this instance.
Well, I imagine that was going to win them some votes. I mean, really, the word that springs to mind is cowardice.
Here's a bit more of Ruddock.
Any more?
Dick Honeywin from the Sydney Rare Fathers. How are you going? Just in your opening speech there, you brought on the subject of protecting the safety of children. Mm. My concern is, and the question at the end of the day is, most fathers are vetted when they go into the family law court system as probably unfit and improper people. They're subjected to a lot of pain through that sort of thing. The new partners are normally not. Doctors' own statistics, brochures off the counters all day, says about 85% of children that are molested are molested by the mother's new partner, further 11% by friends and family member, and 3% at street level. The question is, can we have under the Privacy Act, a facility where we're perhaps a concerned parent or grandparent for that matter, or family or friend member, could go to through their lawyer and ask for a police check on that person that's now in the company of their children, probably residing in the home, got close proximity to children, trusted in that child's company in private. And could we have then a police report that comes back again under the Privacy Act that says this person has been checked out and they are either are or are not a fit and proper person?
They'll tell you whether they've got a record.
Yes, that's what I was getting at. And if they've got, that's all that we can ask for as human beings, because we can't predict the unknown. And then if that person has got a previous record, and there's some very serious people out there, and there's some people prepared to pardon them and put the children in that line of fire, could we then go to the court and simply ask that we have a court order that that person not be allowed to be left alone with our children? In plain language, stop the horse from getting out before, don't close the gate after the horse has bolted.
I wouldn't answer that without wanting to consider all of the implications.
One of the main reasons I want to speak yourself now, and you
in the legal industry. Well, I mean, it does involve quite significant issues. You raised the issue of privacy and so on. I mean, we do have concerns about people who have persistent convictions for paedophilia and so on. I don't imagine you would find that there were all that many people who have adverse criminal records, even if you were to make those inquiries. I don't know that you may find some, but...
That may well then allay fears. People be able to go away saying we've had the privilege of having a person checked out of the system. This person seems to be a decent person.
Tell you what you should do. There is a body at the moment inquiring into privacy laws, and it's called the Australian Law Reform Commission.
Yeah, many of them.
You might like to ask them whether you can make a submission to them in their present review of privacy laws.
Yes, more Philip Ruddockisms, which are basically...
Yes, referring to the Australian Law Reform Commission. The Australian Law Reform Commission recommended an external review of the court after finding profound disquiet both within the legal profession and within the community for the operations of the family court, i.e. they are corrupt to the core. This government ignored the recommendations of the Australian Law Reform Commission, and they'd be in a much better position now if they hadn't.
Also, it was a bit of classic duck shoving, I thought, because domestic violence is a state matter, so they can pass it backwards and forwards. It's not us.
Here's a bit more of Ruddock.
Yeah, this was me. I had him cornered and, yeah.
Attorney General, my name's Ian Purdy. I'm from Dad's on the Air. I'd just like to ask you the question, why Why your government shied away from the presumption of equal shared parenting custody in the face of all of the evidence that shows that by giving one of the parents power over the other parent and basically denying one parent their human right to be a parent, that this opens the floodgates for all of the abuses that everybody at this conference has been talking about all morning.
Well, I'm not going to go over it again. I've already answered.
What I heard was that it was...
What wasn't heard from me was that there was all of the evidence that you say existed at that time, and which you find compelling, was reviewed by a parliamentary committee, a bipartisan parliamentary committee, and they did not recommend it. The government accepted the committee's recommendation. We have implemented the measure. We will see how it works. And if it doesn't work, we may revisit it. But we're not going to revisit it when we determine to follow the recommendation of the committee. In Every Picture Tells a Story. And that is now the law. Okay? All right.
Thank you.
Good.
Yes, the committee did look at it, and in an arbitrary, dishonest way, it just dismissed it in exactly the same way that a family court judgment ignores the evidence and ignores reality. That's what that report did, and that's what the bureaucrat who wrote it did. And the whole issue was raised and dismissed in a couple of paragraphs, and here we have the current mess because this government was too stupid and didn't have the intellectual integrity to monitor what was going on. And make no mistake about it, they didn't hold a committee without knowing what the end result would be, and the end result is a mess. The Fathers for Justice group, active as always, and there's a new film coming out about them later in the year. Paramount Pictures are making a film out of their escapades in London. They have just climbed onto the Statue of Liberty in America. What a great job these guys do. Two British activists from Fathers for Justice have just landed on the Lincoln Memorial. You can see all this on YouTube. And you can see the pictures of it all. One is Jolly Stainsbury, aka Batman, and the other guy, Mike Downs, aka Captain America. They climbed the Lincoln Memorial because of Abraham Lincoln's connection with the abolition of slavery. This humanitarian mission was designed to save children and parents from the ravages of the for-profit divorce industry that terminated the parental rights of thousands of Americans daily. Many believe these courts and actions are unconstitutional, and much is being done to seek federal intervention. About every 2 seconds, a child's bond with one good and fit parent is terminated in America because of a family law system and divorce industry that is in need of serious reform. States receive billions of federal dollars annually as incentives to drive up child support that is paid by American taxpayers. And if at all possible, their system is even worse than ours. We adopted our system from theirs.
The sound. Your pain is painful and it's staring.
So I'm here today at the State Library with South Australian MP Anne Bressington. She's here for an event being held by the Human Rights and Equal Opportunities Commission. She is calling on the federal government to take action to protect children from being caught in the middle of divorce and separation disputes. As we all know, the Howard government has recently gone in with all guns blazing in the Northern Territory, talking about the welfare of Aboriginal children there. Now, Anne is saying that all Australian children deserve the care and protection of the government just as much as the Indigenous children in the Northern Territory. So, Anne, could you tell us a bit more about this stance that you're taking on this issue?
Well, since I've been in politics, and that's been the last 18 months, my office has been literally overwhelmed with fathers. Some mothers too, but the majority seems to be fathers, of people who have been treated unfairly within the family court and the family court system, and also child protection department seems to be enmeshed in that in a lot of the cases. And there just seems to be a lack of political will from the federal government to step in and make the family court system more functional and more equitable for men and women. And I know that there are just thousands of children who are caught in the middle of this conflict and are being forced to choose. Some children, I've heard, have been coerced into making or substantiating false allegations against the fathers. And I just think that we are heading down a path where this is total annihilation and breakdown of the family unit. And the only people that can fix this is the federal government, and specifically the Prime Minister and Mr Ruddock.
And do you think that the new family relationship centres that are being set up are a step in the right direction?
I think the intention behind setting up those centres was admirable. But as always, as it gets administered and managed in the states, usually leaves a lot to be desired. I've had a number of complaints made to my office about the quality of counselling, also about the fact that some of the counsellors in those centres give men the feeling that there is a level of gender bias there. And I've also had that from women who don't want to go after their husbands and ruin them. They just want to get on with their lives. But even those women have made mention to me that it just seems a little off-centre, the approach that they take.
So do you think that the organisations that are running these new centres are staffed by the same sort of people with the same sort of culture that have been involved in the family law industry for a number of years now? And,
yes.
And that some of those old attitudes are still present?
Absolutely. And my research officer was given information that a lot of the people who were in the hierarchy of the Child Protection Department were actually then sequestered, if you like, and planted into some of these counselling services. And some of those people, not all, but some, seem to run their own agenda. And that, to me, is a concern. There seems to be, within this whole area of family law and child protection, a lack of assessment for people to be able to, you know, right person, right job. It seems to be you move up through the ranks, and not always based on performance. You're then planted into a new section of this, or an expansion of this that's actually meant to improve the system. So it seems to maintain the status quo of dysfunction.
Mm. So what are the solutions? What do you think the federal government should be doing to address this huge issue?
Well, number one, they were handed a bill, I believe, by Mr. Steve Fielding from Family First that would have had three adjustments made to family law that I believe, from my experience and limited experience in the legal field, I might add, that those three changes could actually solve the problems that we've got, and that is zero tolerance of false allegations, rebuttable shared parenting, and abolition of case law. And if all of the Family Law Court Act was brought under the Acts Interpretation Act, that would take the power away from the judiciary to interpret the law based on case law, and it would leave it entirely to the legislation to determine the outcomes that should be achieved within family court. That, to me, as a person who's had legislation drawn up, doesn't seem to be a huge task, but for some reason there is a high level of resistance, and I believe Mr. Fielding's bill didn't even get read. So we've got to ask ourselves why. The other thing is, I introduced a bill on a state level to try and combat the issue of false allegations, and that was to polygraph individuals who have made statements about their partner, and that both parties would have the opportunity to undergo a polygraph. And I did that because I know that in South Australia, for the Sex Crimes Investigation Unit, that there is a person trained there in an organisation that is fully trained to do that kind of polygraphing, and the results of that are quite remarkable. And as part of that research, I've had six people who have been falsely accused, or claim they've been falsely accused, polygraphed, and the results were that there was a 98% surety that all of those people were actually telling the truth. So it seems this is child protection, family law is a very emotive issue, and we have now science and technology that can take the human element out of this, can remove whatever prejudices there may be. And this isn't about using the polygraph results in a court of law. This is about using them within the child protection area to better guide social workers on what would be a reasonable case to follow, and also back up that the basis of reasonable suspicion. So if there's a 98% surety that somebody is telling the truth, it should be a pretty good indication that you can move on to the next case.
Especially if you polygraph both people, parties, and you can see that there's a strong chance that one of them isn't telling the truth. You've got a direction to go in.
And you know, we had in another matter, not to do with family court, I had somebody else polygraphed on a work related issue. Not from my office, but an organisation approached me, and one of the parties wasn't being truthful, and it actually showed up that he'd failed by minus 14 points. So it does work both ways, and it is very accurate. And this has been used now in the United States for sex crimes investigation, pedophilia, all of that sort of thing now for about the last 8 to 10 years, I think. And it's proven to be very effective. And I can't for the life of me understand why there's that technology available. And in Australia, we seem to want to just stick to what obviously isn't working well.
Because, of course, to be fair, the issue is not just false allegations, it's also false denials. So
yes,
you also have cases where children are genuinely being abused by their father or stepfather.
Absolutely.
And those cases aren't being followed up, and those children are suffering. So they need protection, but also the fathers that are being falsely accused need help as well. And this system would seem to work for both of those cases.
Well, it does. And the thing is that I think in every state across Australia, this is an issue. And always the hue and cry of the government is there's just not enough funds. We can't hire the amount of staff that we need to cover the 30,000 odd complaints that we get in South Australia. So this is a two-hour process. Imagine the funds, the time and the energy that would be saved within a department if we could cull out the false allegations, identify when a case is legitimate, and have social workers and child protection workers follow through on those cases that are absolutely indicated to be where children are at risk. But, you know, the legal profession and the judiciary, for some reason, and I say that with tongue-in-cheek, aren't keen on the polygraphing bill.
Gee, I wonder why.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, that's another concern of mine too, is the access and availability of legal aid, especially for parents who are, I guess, trying to fight for their rights. And I've seen this, as I said, both with males and females, but the majority is men who have great difficulty getting legal aid. And when they get it, they don't get enough to see it right through to the end. When there has been a false allegation made, they can't pursue that with legal aid funding. They've got to go through, I believe, the civil court to have the perjury matter dealt with, and they just don't have the resources to do that. So they walk around with that stigma basically for the rest of their life, and I've seen men whose lives have been ruined because of that. So there's a lot of adjustment needed, and it's not rocket science. It's doable. And I call on Mr. Howard and Mr. Ruddock to take this seriously. And I also call on the people who are being affected by this to stand behind and make this an election issue, because, as I believe, there are almost at least 1,000 men a year suicide because of these very issues. And I would imagine that they are lives that are worth saving.
Independent MP Anne Bressington from South Australia, thank you so much for talking with Dads on the Air today.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers.
And thanks for joining us at Dads on the Air for the 21st of August. In the studio, we've had Ian Purdy, Peter Vanderford, Greg Anderson, our researcher, and myself, John Stapleton. Next week, don't miss our Father's Day special. We have Matt O'Connor, the founder of Fathers for Justice, an American soldier fighting in Iraq, Eric Burke, that should be a fascinating interview, and Warwick Marsh from the Fatherhood Foundation. We'll be back next week. With Dads on